versus Ryobi Technologies, 12-2984. Mr. Carpinello.
May it please the Court, George Carpinello, Boies Schiller and Flexner, for the plaintiff, Brandon Stallings. Your Honors, the verdict must be set aside in this case and a new trial granted because of the conduct of defense counsel, which even the district court characterized as an unusual and uncommon sustained assault on Brandon Stallings' own counsel. This entire case was permeated with an attack on myself and Mr. Sullivan by name throughout the entire case. Defense counsel started the case by telling the jury that this really wasn't a personal injury case, but it was a case designed to extort money from the manufacturers, that if the manufacturers did not pay Dr. Gass, one of our experts, a patent fee of 8%, that Mr. Carpinello, by name, would go after that manufacturer and sue them. And that Mr. Carpinello and Mr. Sullivan have brought 90 cases throughout the United States against manufacturers for one purpose and one purpose only, to extort a fee on behalf of Dr. Gass, forcing them to obtain their patents. Defense counsel went so far as to say that this was a patent law case masquerading as a personal injury case. Even the district judge found that the defense counsel's actions, while appropriate to attack the credibility of Dr. Gass on the stand and to show that Dr. Gass, as an expert witness, may have had an axe to grind, went far beyond that, as the district court said, crossed the line and engaged in a concerted attack on the integrity of defense counsel.
Ask you about that. I'm frankly a little confused when I read the transcript here, because I see the district judge repeatedly saying that defense counsel had crossed a line and that some corrective measures were necessary, but then stopped short of saying that he wasn't going to say that the conduct was wrong, and then really didn't seem to take any curative steps.
That's exactly our point. First of all, the district judge was truly surprised by what defense counsel had done and was taken aback. And the district judge did say, incidentally, Your Honor, this issue was discussed after trial on four separate days. That's how long, and we had hours and hours of colloquy of how to cure this. But the district judge said, you've crossed the line, but I'm not saying anything you did was improper. The district judge felt, having let defense counsel go on for literally minutes and minutes and minutes in his opening talking about this, I think felt that he didn't want to back away and say that what you've done is improper. So what he said was...
I'm curious. I have not found that you asked for a mistrial at any point on this grounds.
We did not ask for a mistrial, but we objected.
Nor did you ask for a new trial.
As we're not required to under...
Of course. But Judge Feinerman was the judge on the scene who saw this, who heard it, who had a sense of the jury, who had a great feel, I would presume a great feel for what the dynamics of the trial were. And you didn't request that he stop that trial, give you another shot at it, or overturn the verdict and allow you another opportunity with some more restrictions in place as to what could be done.
What we did do is, first of all, I objected immediately when this statement started. Then we raised it. We made a motion to the court. We made a motion to the court that the court advise the jury that it was improper, that the court give a curative instruction at the end of the case, that the court stopped defense counsel from doing what they were doing. He denied it, and he went on at length to say, I'm going to allow it all to happen because why? Because Dr. Gass is an expert, and this goes to Dr. Gass's credibility. But he admitted that, as Your Honor points out, that they had clearly crossed the line. But the judge kept saying, but I'm not saying it's improper. I'm just saying I have to do something about it. And what the judge said I'm going to do about it is, I'm going to tell the jury that you guys actually won a case. That's what I'm going to tell the jury, which I think was patently inadequate. There's no question that we gave the trial judge ample opportunity. We debated this During the morning session of July 30th, during the evening session of July 30th, during August 1st, during August 2nd, and it came up again the morning of August 3rd when we charged the jury. We didn't expressly ask for a mistrial. We consistently asked the judge to stop it, to stop the improper conduct, and he declined to do so.
The difficulty that I have is that when a trial judge is faced with something like this, the judge decides how to handle it. The judge has some feel for what the dynamics of the trial are, as I said, and we defer substantially to how a judge decides to conduct a trial. And I think you're asking us to set aside that usual deference that we give to the trial judge.
Because I think I think clearly there was an abuse of discretion. There's no question. And this court, in many cases, despite the deference the trial judge has said, the conduct of prosecution or defense counsel or plaintiff's counsel was beyond the pale here, which it clearly was. I don't think there's any...
He never did find misconduct, though, did he?
No. In fact, he thought it was all totally appropriate. He said to the last day, I find this to be perfectly appropriate. I think a motion for a mistrial, given the fact that in four separate days, he said, Mr. Bell, you've crossed the line, but I'm not saying you did anything inappropriate. I'm just saying I have to do something about it. What a motion would a mistrial would have done? It would have been a waste of time because the judge made it very clear that he thought that there was no misconduct. Incidentally,
of course, I'm wondering whether you thought maybe it was going your way, that you thought this jury wasn't buying that program and that you had a real good shot with this jury.
Well, the evidence was overwhelming of liability. There's no question about that, and which is why I think a defense verdict was. I don't think there's any conclusion that could be drawn but that what defense counsel did had an impact on the jury. The evidence was overwhelming that they put out a saw with a guard that even they knew was defective. In fact, their chief engineer testified, I don't even use the guard because I think the guard clouds up. The whole reason Brandon Stalling said he didn't use the guard is because it clouds up. It's unsafe to use the guard. And their own chief engineer who designed saws for them said, I don't use that guard. I made my own guard because it clouds up. And they never challenged the efficacy of the flesh detection technology that Stephen Gass had invented. But they go ahead and say it was really our fault. We brought this on ourselves because we chose to have the inventor of the technology, which was offered to them 13 years ago, we chose to have that person testify as a fact witness and as an expert witness. You don't need to be in the courtroom, Your Honor, to read the cold record to see the inappropriateness of the language used. They accused plaintiff's counsel of extortion. He said on several occasions in his opening and again in his closing, and he implied it in his cross-examination of Dr. Gass, that we were part of his team and we had brought this lawsuit and other lawsuits around the country for one purpose, to force the manufacturers to pay a royalty to Dr. Gass. That's patently inappropriate to attack the integrity. It's unethical to attack the integrity of opposing counsel. There was no evidence of it.
Well, and if there was evidence of it, it's not inappropriate. Would you agree with that? If there's evidence of a financial interest that counsel have with a witness, that would be some grounds of bias.
Yes, and I stood up and I said, when the words first came out of Mr. Bell's mouth, I stood up and I said, Judge, there's no good faith basis to make this argument. There's no evidence of it. There's been no evidence in discovery. The only evidence was this blow-up of the article from the Oregonian, which was blatant hearsay, and I objected to that. In his opening, he puts a newspaper article underlined, and he talks about it during his entire opening. The article was hearsay, and I objected before we even started the case. I said, Judge, this newspaper article is hearsay. And the judge said, no, I'm going to let it in because he can use it in cross-examination of Dr. Gass. That was wrong, by the way, because you can't use a hearsay to cross-examine a witness. You can use a prior inconsistent statement of the witness, and it wasn't the witness's statement. It was a statement made by a reporter in a newspaper article, and Dr. Gass said, I never made the statement. And in his closing, Mr. Bell made it even worse by misrepresenting the facts of the jury, saying, you know, Dr. Gass said, these cases are all being brought so he can get a patent. He doesn't deny that he said that in the Oregonian article. He flatly denied it in his testimony. It was just an outright fabrication of what the testimony said. I thought trial lawyers had an obligation in a closing to represent the facts that came before the jury. He flatly misrepresented the testimony of Dr. Gass. In addition,
Mr. Carpinello, let me ask you on the instruction that the district judge gave in an attempt to cure what was perceived to be something of a problem by the district judge. Says you may consider this information about other table saw cases solely for the purposes of, one, evaluating the weight of Dr. Gass's testimony. I get that. Okay. Two, considering whether the other table saw cases brought by Mr. Carpinello and Mr. Sullivan, you and your co-counsel, in which Dr. Gass served as an expert, were brought to force table saw manufacturers to license table saw technology. Where did that language come from in the back and forth over what instruction would be given?
That language came from the judge, and here's the background of that, Judge. We proposed, and it's in the record in two separate places, the judge said, all I'm going to let you do, first of all, we asked to talk about the other cases, to talk about the merits of the other cases, because contrary to well-established case law in this circuit and others, he raised the other cases. And you can't raise other cases unless there's evidence that they were fraudulent or frivolous. So we said, what are you going to do about that, Judge? We want to talk about the other cases. And the judge said, I'm not going to let you talk about what happened in the other cases. I'm going to only let you talk about the Osorio case. And I'm not going to say it was this defendant. I'm not going to say it was in Boston. So I gave a charge on that limited thing. And he said, well, I'm going to add to that that they can't. I have to say, if you're going to say that, I have to say you can only consider this about the credibility of Dr. Gass. And then I said, well, that's a problem, too, because he used it against Mr. Sullivan and me. And then he said, well, okay, I'll talk about Mr. Sullivan and you in the same charge. And we accepted that only as a last resort because, we didn't want this kind of charge at all. We wanted to talk about that. We wanted to get evidence in the merits of the cases. But that one and two paragraph was written by the judge, and at the end we accepted it because we had nothing else. We said, we don't like your charge, Judge. We want our charge. But if you're going to use your charge, we'll agree to do this. But we don't like this. And the fact is, there was nothing the judge could do. Once he had let all this testimony in, once he had allowed Mr. Bell not only to impugn us during his opening, but throughout the entire case, every time there was a deposition, he'd reference the deposition, and he'd say, was that Mr. Sullivan from Wesley, Massachusetts? Was that Mr. Carpolino from New York? And he pointed to us and he'd say, were those the lawyers that were at that deposition? And that was another case, right? And he'd say, they were at that deposition, right? That was, as they admitted to the judge, that was their theory of the case. That's what they said to the judge. This conspiracy is our theory of the case. It was patently improper and it pervaded the entire trial. I think I'm getting into my...
I'd like to hear about the sole proximate cause.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. The pattern jury instructions in Illinois say the sole proximate cause charge is only to be given when there's an allegation that a third party was responsible. And the reason for that is, and the reason why the defendants took this gambit of dropping their comparative negligence claim and going to sole proximate cause is because they knew it would confuse the jury. And we pointed that out to the judge in the May hearing. And I said to the judge, if you're going to let them go on sole proximate cause, we ask that you charge the jury that if they're found even 1% responsible, that we win. And the judge said, Ms. Bell, you agree with that? And she said, yes, Your Honor. He said, you got it. And then at the trial, he reneged on the commitment. And this was raised... five different times in the case. I said, Judge, you have to talk. If you're going to let them do a sole proximate cause, which they won't understand, and if you read the charge, there's no way a lay jury can distinguish between a proximate cause and sole proximate cause. And we said, Judge, you have to do two things. You have to talk in percentage terms in your charge, and you have to let the jury accord fault. It was very important in this case to have an appropriation of fault, because Brandon Stallings admitted he didn't use the guard. And throughout the case, they said, you didn't use the guard. You should have used the guard. And we wanted to give the jury an opportunity to apportion fault. And the judge wouldn't do it. And then the judge said, I'm not going to talk about percentages, even though if you look at the colloquy about the charge, the judge keeps saying to the defense witnesses, why can't I talk in percentages? And they stood up and remonstrated and demanded, said, no, Judge, you can't mention percentages at all, because that was part of their gambit to confuse the jury. And the judge said, you, Mr. Carpinello, you can talk about percentages in your closing. So I do talk about percentages, and I get an objection. And the judge says to the jury, the charge on the law is to come from me, not the attorneys. So the judge cut my legs out from under me because the jury saw that I was talking about percentages, and the judge didn't give anything about percentages in his charge. So what I said to the jury looked to be totally illegitimate. And clearly this is a gambit that the defense counsel said they've used in this case, they're going to use in other cases. The jury cannot distinguish between a proximate cause and sole proximate cause, and there was overwhelming evidence that the defendants had engaged in all kinds of wrongful conduct, but the jury couldn't distinguish and draw an appropriation between those two.
Mr. Carpinello, could I ask you quickly about, or did you want to follow up? Sorry, Mr. Carpinello, I wanted to ask you about this. This apparently seems to be part of a nationwide siege. Lots of accidents, lots of litigation. Are there other cases pending in this circuit or in the Illinois District Courts at this point?
Yes. I don't know, recall how many, but there are cases that have been brought throughout the United States, and the genesis of this was that insurance companies insuring, providing workers' compensation have been paying out because of all these injuries from table saws. The CPSC says there's 33,000 hospitally treated injuries from table saws every single year. And so the insurance companies were saying, what's going on here? And then Gas had come on the scene and had presented his flush detection technology, and everybody wondered why weren't the manufacturers adopting it.
I'm just trying to understand. I mean, the issues here seem to be ones that are going to come up again and again and again in trials.
Yes.
And I want to get some sense of the urgency for our disposition.
Well, there's a case that's going to trial in Wisconsin, I believe, this fall, the Thull case. Minnesota.
They don't have to listen to us.
They don't have to listen. But there are literally dozens of cases throughout the United States in various stages. In the Walgus case, which was coming up for trial right after this one, Judge Kim said...
That settled, didn't it?
They settled, but Judge Kim, and we put it in the record, Judge Kim said, I'm not going to let any of this go on. And I've got the benefit of having seen you do it, unlike Judge Feinerman, and it's not going to happen in my courtroom. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Bohm?
That's a familiar name.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Garrett Bohm, and I represent the defendants in this matter. The plaintiffs came forth with a difficult case to prove. They had the burden to show that this saw was defective and unreasonably dangerous. The problem that they had there initially was that this saw complied with the standards as published by UL and also at OSHA. Their second problem was that they had a plaintiff who admittedly had misused the saw. He had not read the owner's manual. He had not heeded any of the warnings. He had not put the guard, the 3-in-1 guard, on the saw. And he conceded that if that saw had been in place, he probably wouldn't have been injured. Now, as to the allegations of misconduct that are clearly the central focus of my opponent's appeal, I think it's important to examine exactly how much that played a role in this case. And I would say that it was a very, very small role.
It was half of your opening statement.
It was certainly touched upon in the opening statement, and you look at it, the opening statement as a continuum.
I read it. It's half.
I've read it quite a few times as well.
Right.
It's part of the final argument as well.
It's your theory.
It was in the
case.
Final argument as well. That was stated.
It
is part of the case, certainly. And I'm not going to veer away from that at all. I can't. But you look at how that statement was made in the opening statement, and where the focus was upon...
I apologize for mispronouncing your name, but your colleague says this isn't even a products liability case. Here you're saying it was a hard case for the plaintiff, and your colleague is portraying it as a fraudulent patent case, basically.
That statement, I would submit to the court, was also, you have to take it in context, that the focus was upon Dr. Gass and his bias and his motive. And for Dr. Gass, we would submit that it really was more of an IP focus that he had. It wasn't an IP case. It was a product liability case. But the focus for him was upon his intellectual property and pushing that such that it would be adopted in the industry as the guarding standard and that he would...
Well, let's go to this newspaper article.
Okay.
Under what basis is that article admissible?
I think we go to the beginning of how that article was presented to the court.
It's chock full of hearsay.
When there is certainly this double hearsay within that article.
Absolutely.
And how that article first came to light was as an exhibit, as a plaintiff's exhibit, number 95 in the pretrial order.
To which you objected.
We objected.
On hearsay.
We objected to the PTI letter to which it was attached as hearsay. Prior to trial, we decided to use
that. Started looking a lot better to you then.
We decided to use that article because of statements that appeared within it. There was an objection to hearsay that was made by the plaintiff, and that was overruled by the judge, stating that he thought it would be used in cross-examination.
How? How was that appropriate?
I think what you have to do is look at the indicia of reliability in this article.
Are you kidding? You're treating a newspaper article as reliable evidence? Is this like a new residual exception to the hearsay rule?
No, it's not, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I would say...
If you want to present a witness with a prior inconsistent statement, you've got to have evidence that the statement was, in fact, made by the witness. You don't have that here.
We don't.
Okay.
It's not there.
So on what conceivable basis can this come into evidence?
My answer to that is really looking at it from the question of what statements in that article were made that were at issue and disagreed with by Dr. Gass. And it falls upon one word, and that one word is force, that he sought to force the industry to accept his technology.
Pretty powerful word.
And he said, no, I didn't say that. That's the reporter's interpretation of my words.
But that's the theme of your case, that Mr. Stolling's case is just part of this venture to compel the industry to adopt the flesh detection technology to make Dr. Gass wealthy.
I would submit, Your Honor, that was a subplot, and it was not a. There are many themes.
What was the main plot?
There are many.
If that wasn't the theme, what was the main plot?
Well, the main plot was how this saw was used by Mr. Stallings, and that testimony was very clear as to how it was used, how it was misused.
The same way your chief safety engineer uses his, right? Mm. Without the 3-in-1 guard.
Mm-hmm. He has modified it in his own shop. Certainly that is within the record.
Yeah.
And Mr. Stallings conceded, if I had used this guard, which, by the way, is certified by UL and complies with OSHA standards, I wouldn't have been injured. That was the main defense. That was the defense of this case. Now, how much did the issue about the reference to the joint venture, when did that occur? It occurred in the opening statement about four times.
With the blow-up, right? It was on the document camera or something. And
well, there's
form,
no
highlighted.
There's no mention of joint venture. There were statements in the. Are you talking about the article that were discussed in opening statement? But the reference to joint venture occurred four times in opening statement. It did not happen after that. And I think I would, as to whether there was some discussion of whether it crossed the line, I think I would point out how Judge Feinerman first viewed those statements. And this appears well into the record on page 1090. He says, what he's doing knowingly is testifying in product liability cases, something that he does not have to do. He's talking about Dr. Gass, certainly not as an expert. And what he hopes is that these saws of his, the saws of his competitors, will be found by juries to be defectively designed. That will help him in the marketplace and will give him vindication for what has been his life's work over the past decade. He couldn't do that in these cases, and so that's Dr. Gass. And he's using these cases as a vehicle for doing that. And the plaintiff's lawyers have to know that, because why is he doing this for free? He's doing it for free because he is getting a different kind of financial advantage out of his participation in these cases, or so a reasonable jury can conclude. And that's not the only statement like that that is made. Now, as to how it may have crossed the line, I think it's important to look at exactly how Judge Fireman described that crossing of the line. He says, and this is on page 1963 of the record, what was actually said during the opening statement, and was the line crossed? And by saying, was the line crossed, I'm not saying the line was crossed from propriety into impropriety. I'm saying, was the line crossed where something was put on the table that allows the plaintiff to get into the Osorio verdict? And that's what I mean by, whenever I say line crossed, that's really what I'm saying. So the question was there the implication within that opening statement that the other 90 cases that have been filed by plaintiff's counsels are meritless? And the judge said, no, that statement has never been made explicitly, but I think it was implied within the opening statement, so I need to do something about it. And what I'm going to do about it is give a curative instruction. Now, he gave that other table saws instruction to the jury. When you look at other cases involving alleged plaintiff counsel misconduct, they don't reach this case at all. They're much more egregious, and they involve other factors. For instance, the inability to give rebuttal testimony, evidence, argument within the trial. Certainly, opposing counsel had the ability to rebut any of those statements made in the opening statement, had the ability to rebut the Oregonian article. Certainly, they did that with Dr. Gass. They had, and then that there was also, for instance, in the Buford case, there was discussion in a sidebar that the plaintiff's counsel, against whom these allegations of unmeritorious cases had been made, would be put in jail. And unfortunately, the jury heard that. So there, it was not just a matter of, and in Buford, I will also say, these allegations of misconduct were throughout, permeated the entire trial. Now, I would submit to this court that these implications of what Judge Fineman saw to be implications of filing meritless cases certainly did not permeate this entire case from beginning to end. It occurs in pages 49 to 55 of the opening statement, and also on page 61. There are very few questions asked of Dr. Gass in his cross-examination with regard to the Oregonian article and whether or not he sought to force manufacturers to adopt.
On that point, Mr. Bain, could you tell me where that the article, I think it was Exhibit 95,
correct,
was actually admitted into evidence?
It's difficult to see in the record.
That's why I'm asking.
It is. I've thought about that over the last few days. And what happened when the pretrial order was submitted, and there were also amendments to that prior to trial, the agreement was that any exhibits that were not objected to would be admitted. Now, we objected to Exhibit 95, so it was not immediately admitted. However, then we used it in opening statement, and then plaintiff...
Over objection. Yes.
And then plaintiff used it in the direct examination of Dr. Gass, and then it was again used in cross-examination of Dr. Gass.
Did the district judge have in place some kind of standing order or understanding that if you mentioned an exhibit without objection, it would be admitted into evidence or anything like that?
I don't recollect that.
It obviously was treated as if it had been admitted into evidence, but I just don't see a moment where the judge says, okay, I hear the objections, they're overruled, it's in.
There was discussion near the end of the trial about whether or not certain exhibits came into evidence, and most of that discussion was about rebuttal exhibits.
Not about 95.
And not about 95. So it's not explicit.
Weren't the exhibits sent to the jury room with the jurors during deliberation?
Many exhibits were sent to the jury room, including Exhibit 95, was my understanding, yes. Yes. So
could I ask you about this sole proximate cause exhibit, or jury instruction, rather? I'm trying to understand the instruction and how it would benefit the defendant if the jury had properly understood it. If the jury properly understood it, I think plaintiff's right. 1% responsibility for the defense, and you're liable for all the injuries after you abandon the comparative fault approach, right?
I would, if the if defendant was found to be 1% reliable, they would have satisfied the proximate cause element of their claims.
And there would be no apportionment.
And there would be no apportionment.
So you'd be responsible for the whole thing. Plaintiff was right about that. Now,
true.
So that seems like a pretty risky strategy unless the jury is confused.
I think you could characterize it as a risky strategy, but we, defense counsel obviously was confident in that strategy.
Well,
I don't think that the jury was confused.
Well, let me if I understand, if the way comparative fault works in Illinois, let's suppose the judge had asked the jury to apportion fault. If they'd come in, plaintiff was 60% responsible, defendant 40%, the result would be a defense verdict, right?
Correct.
But under these instructions, 1% defense responsibility equals 100% verdict for the plaintiff. Right?
If all the elements are met, correct.
Right. So how does this make any sense from a defense standpoint? If the jury understood that correctly.
It was the defense's standpoint that we did not want to argue percentages and form of 30% at fault, 40% at fault, 50% at fault. We thought the stronger position was to argue there's nothing wrong with this saw. It complied with industry standards. If it had been used correctly, the injury would not have happened, so we're not at fault at all.
Mm-hmm. Explain to me how this sole proximate cause instruction makes sense in light of the comments of the committee that put together the Illinois pattern instruction saying don't give this in this kind of a case.
The comments to that, 12.04, I believe it is, IPA 12.04, discuss how it applies to non-parties. And then if looking at the McDonald versus McPartland case, which we cited, there's discussion that it applies to anyone if there is allegation that anyone other than the defendant is solely responsible for the accident. And that would include the plaintiff. This sole proximate cause instruction has been used in many trials.
Was sort of the empty chair defense. That is, when someone who's not
there, 12.04.
A non-party, that's what the purpose of this instruction.
That's 12.04, and Judge Feinerman recognized that. And he said, this doesn't really fit into this case, but I'm going to use some of the language in there as a model.
How does, has the Illinois Supreme Court, this is a question of state law, we need to defer to them, predict how they would deal with it. Has the Illinois Supreme Court given any indication that this is an appropriate use of a sole proximate cause instruction?
I believe the McDonald versus McPartland case is an appellate court case and not a Supreme Court case.
No, it's an Illinois Supreme Court case, but it was not directed toward the plaintiff. It was directed toward a non-party physician. In that case.
And there is dicta in there that talks about how it applies to anyone other than the defendant. So that's the best there is to offer. That's my answer to that. I want to address one issue that my opposing counsel discussed with regard to whether or not he was able to argue percentages. It appears on page 2739 in his closing argument. He says, so the question is, do they bear any responsibility? Do they have any responsibility at all? 1%? 10%? 30%? Do they have any responsibility for this accident? And if you conclude that they do, then you must return a verdict for Brandon Stallings. There's no objection to that. The standard of review that this court is going to apply is one that is very deferential. And there must be a concrete showing that the misconduct of counsel, if there is misconduct, consistently permeated the entire trial from beginning to end.
Where does that standard come from?
It was cited in the briefs.
I saw a Sixth Circuit case being cited for that. It struck me as a rather extraordinarily stringent standard, since you could, in essence, launch one harpoon that would be fatal and not have to do it repeatedly.
Well, if that harpoon is fatal, then maybe you could make the argument that it has, because it's fatal, it has permeated the entire case. I don't think there was a fatal harpoon in this case. And I would say, looking at the cases that the plaintiff has cited, their best cases being Buford and Kiefel, those cases don't, this case does not rise to that standard of misconduct requiring a new trial. Consequently, I would ask this court to affirm the verdict below, and thank you.
I had one question.
Yes.
Maybe you can't answer, because there's an earlier reference to workers' comp cases. Obviously, those are industrial accidents of some kind. This was a personal thing, I guess, a homeowner or somebody,
yeah,
whatever it was. Of the so-called 90, maybe you don't know the answer, but if there are 90 cases, how many of those are industrial accidents versus these that happen maybe in one's own garage?
I can't answer that, Your Honor. I don't know.
Right, maybe you don't know. I'm just curious making that distinction, because obviously when you had workers' comp, that's not... There's no issue with liability. It's a question of they pay it. And then, of course, you go to the product liability case, and that's a separate action. But that's just a curiosity I have. But
unfortunately, I don't have that information.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Your Honors.
3 minutes, Mr. Carpinello.
Your Honor is correct. That's not the standard in the Seventh Circuit. The standard is in Whiting. To obtain a new trial on attorney misconduct grounds, the party must show both that the misconduct occurred and that it prejudiced their case. I don't think that there's any question it prejudiced our case. With regard to the statement in my closing and sole proximate cause, I did start to talk about the percentages, but 2 pages later, when I start to get into more detail, defense counsel stood up and objected, and the trial judge told the jury that he, not the attorneys, will give charge on the law. And I think that clearly undercut my credibility in front of the jury, because he declined to give the percentage charge. To answer your question that was asked of my adversary, the Supreme Court of Illinois has never expressly addressed this issue, whether you can use sole proximate cause, a defendant can use sole proximate cause in this way, and this is clearly a case designed for comparative negligence. And yes, it is, Your Honor, it is a risky step, except unless you're banking on the jury not understanding the difference between a proximate cause and sole proximate cause, which is why we argued with the judge on 3 separate occasions that you had to tell the jury more than what you're going to tell them. On the issue of standards, he raises the point that the SAW complied with the standards. We asked the judge, he gave a charge in this long paragraph on what unreasonably dangerous is. He said, you can consider industry standards. I said, if you're going to say that, Judge, you have to say that it's not conclusive. The fact they comply with industry standards, which, by the way, they wrote, is not conclusive, and he declined to do that. I do want to briefly say that with regard to Dr. Graham, clearly the case law in this circuit, Smith v. Ford, is that the factual input that an expert gives is a matter for cross-examination. This witness was acknowledged to be an expert in his field, and the judge expressly said that his methodology was proper. The 90%, he struck it solely on the 90% issue when, first of all, Dr. Gass had testified a month earlier before the hearing, and it's in the record. It's item 254 in the record. Dr. Gass had already testified, and they were going to take his deposition again 2 weeks later, that it was in excess of 90%, and Gass was the source of the number. The judge had a problem with the fact that Dr. Graham had cited to one deposition where Gass said the vast majority of cases. But Gass confirmed in a deposition before the trial that it was in excess of 90%, and they had an opportunity to examine Gass on that because they insisted on getting yet another deposition of Gass, which they got before the trial. So there was no prejudice, and Dr. Graham should have come in. Graham was crucial in this case because Graham was the only witness that could put in real terms to the jury that the cost of these accidents was far in excess of the cost of putting the technology on the saw. And that was their only defense with regard to flesh detection technology.
The defense did argue that that was too expensive.
I'm sorry?
The defense did argue that SawStop was too expensive.
Exactly. That was their whole case, that this small saw, you can't put it on the saw. It costs $50 to $75 to put it on the saw. Graham's testimony was At 90% effectiveness, the cost to society per saw, not per accident, per saw, is over $700. Even if you don't take the 90%, drop it to 50%. Drop Graham's number to 50%. It's still like three times the cost of putting it on the saw. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. And the case will be taken under advisement.